So here's the thing. You know, I've been doing this work for, as you said, many years, Gordon. Doing this work, but over the last, maybe I want to say 10 years, what I was really starting to dive in is kind of this systems thinking. How do we pull systems together to really think at a systems lens rather than just thinking at a criminal justice lens and reducing recidivism, or thinking through the public health lens and maybe looking at prescription drug monitoring programs to address the opioid overdose epidemic, or just thinking through harm reduction, right? Those are very siloed pieces that are effective, but what happens when we come together and really think through it as a system lens to get better outcomes?
From PHI Media, I'm Gordon Thane, and this is The Story of the Opioid Epidemic, Episode 214, Substance Use, Criminal Justice, and Public Health Advocacy on Capitol Hill. You're listening to the Public Health Insight Podcast, your go-to space for all things public health and global health, from the Sustainable Development Goals to the social determinants of health, as well as interesting dialogues about the diverse career opportunities that exist in these fields. Remember to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so other people like you can benefit from our content. The opioid crisis is as rampant as any other time in history, and a lot of work remains to be done until we can feel the progress being made. Every so often, though, we have the privilege of meeting someone behind the work, someone who's committed a significant portion of their profession and of their lives to creating a world where the opioid epidemic is no more. What you are about to hear is chapter 1 of 3 in this mini-series, where LaShawn and myself sit down with Dr. Jennifer Loeffler-Cobia, who graciously shares her journey into public health and her transition into criminal justice, why she got her DRPH many years after her master's degree, and her experiences advocating for policy change on Capitol Hill. Dr. Loeffler-Cobia is a Director of Justice and Public Health Policy and Practice at WestEd Justice and Prevention Research Center, and also an Adjunct Associate Professor for the Bovard College at the University of Southern California, where she teaches systems thinking to solve complex public health and criminal justice issues. Before this, she started off where so many of us have gone before, pursuing an education in public health. We have Dr. Jennifer Loeffler-Cobia joining us on the Public Health Insight podcast. Dr. Jen, welcome.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited.
I'm excited too. And one of the reasons I'm particularly excited is around, so in the modern day, public health, I feel like, has not been more popular than at any time in history, for obvious reasons with the COVID-19 pandemic and SARS, 20-ish, just short of 20-ish years before that. So it's in the public consciousness now. And now what we're seeing is a lot of young people, people who are starting their career, pursuing public health intentionally, whereas before, a lot of people fell into it by accident, not really knowing when they started school or undergrad training that there was a space for prevention work or public health work, so to speak. But when I was digging into your background on page 30 of Google, just kidding, I did see your career, your bachelor's, was in public health. Did you know about public health? Did you always know that, yes, I want to be doing this? Because I found that very rare, and not to date it or anything, we're talking about 1996. So situate us with that Bachelor of Public Health.
So, yes, my path in my career, it kind of took some different trajectories. I had an older sister who was, at the time, she was 6 years older than me. She was in medical school at the University of Utah. And I thought, oh, I'm going to follow her footsteps, and I'm going to go to medical school, and I'm going to be a doctor. And I thought, you know, I'm going to be a pediatrician or, you know, something down along those lines. And that was the path I was going. As I got into my college career and started some of my pre-med classes, you know, it really struck me that, and it was interesting because this was the early 90s and we just weren't really talking about public health. But I was thinking through, as I was going through some of my courses, you know, how do these diseases, and especially like communicable diseases, how do these things affect populations? You know, how do we prevent these things from happening? As a medical doctor, I can come in and I can say, oh, you know, diagnose you, you've got these symptoms, so forth and so on. We diagnose you, we give you treatment, and you move on along your way. But as a public health specialist, I really wanted to look at the population. How do we prevent these things from happening altogether, whether it's cardiovascular disease or diabetes or whatever it might be? And on a funny note, my older sister sat me down and said, Jen, I'm kind of thinking you're a little too social to go to med school. So she's like, you know, you really got to buckle down if you're going to really go to med school too. So on a side note, she kind of had a conversation with me too about it. And then she and I kind of found this degree at the University of Utah in public health. And that's, so then I started looking at that. I looked at nursing, public health nursing. But I ended up going into straight into public health because I really wanted to get into that prevention piece and look at how things affect population, whether it's a disease like COVID, we've all experienced that, or, you know, substance misuse, violence, you know, going through populations. You know, it doesn't have to just be a disease, but anything that affects populations. And how do we understand the root causes of it to better be able to make policies and implement programs that address it so that we can prevent it altogether? So that's where I got, in education-wise, how I took my path that I did.
And then when you started that degree, were things at the time playing out how you expected it to play out in terms of what you were learning, how you thought you would apply those skills? Did you know what types of careers you could have done with that degree? Because you had that problem-solving mindset of, okay, what does prevention look like? But did you know, like, okay, once I graduated, I can do that to be able to apply my skill sets and serve populations? Did you have that clear picture at that time?
I'm not sure if I had a clear picture, but what I wanted to do at that time with my bachelor's of public health was I really saw myself at the Centers for Disease Control at the CDC chasing the Ebola virus. I mean, that was in essence what I wanted to do early on in my career is, you know, eventually get to the CDC and work in communicable diseases. But as you probably saw, my career path took a very strange trajectory into criminal justice.
After working for a few years, Dr. Loeffler Kolbia completed her Master of Science in Health Research and Evaluation at Utah State University. In the time leading up to this, she had been working in the area of communicable diseases. And then something surprising happened. Public health had now gained roots in the criminal justice sector, and it opened up the possibilities for her to bring what she had learned to explore very difficult systems-level challenges, such as why people with a criminal record were more likely than others to be justice-involved again in the future. So you finish your bachelor's, and then you're doing your master's of science and focusing on research and evaluation. So you knew about, okay, I'm going to do public health, did my bachelor's, and then you end up in, I'm going to do research and evaluation specifically. Help us connect the dots between niching down into that area.
Yep. So I didn't go into my master's until years, oh gosh, I want to say 15 years
right,
later.
Right, right, yeah.
Right? So what happened was between my bachelor's and my master's was I was working at a local public health department, working in communicable diseases. HIV was a big topic at the time, and so we were doing a lot of HIV education, epidemiology into HIV, so forth and so on, and really using those public health models, right, of looking at root causes. What are the root causes of the disease? Who's it affecting? Who's the target population that it's affecting? So then we can then develop policies and practices. But what happened was, is ironically enough, with what I do now with systems thinking, there was a collaborative effort going on in the community that I lived in with criminal justice. Mm. And there was this kind of philosophical shift in criminal justice at the time that was really taking a public health model in criminal justice. The research was coming out to say, hey, if we take this epidemiology framework into criminal justice, look at root causes of recidivism, what's highly correlated with recidivism, How then do we put treatment plans together to reduce recidivism? Therefore, we should see a reduction in crime and in our communities. And it was really this public health model or medical model that was coming out in criminal justice. So the problem was, is that criminal justice at the time was more punitive, right? than more restorative. And they weren't really sure how to implement the research that was coming out, and really empirical research. Over and over, we were seeing these types of frameworks in criminal justice being effective. But they weren't really ready to implement this type of model, right? So they started pulling folks in, like myself, that were public health folks that understood root causes of diseases, treatment plans, so forth and so on. And we got pulled into coalitions and committees. And that's how I started my trajectory down criminal justice, is really helping that part of the system, that organization, to really think through how to implement this type of process, because we were showing that it worked to reduce recidivism. But I knew nothing about social work. I knew nothing about the criminal justice system. So I immersed myself in that organization to learn about, you know, judicial, the court system, community corrections, juvenile justice, and really understanding how that process and how folks go through that system. So I worked as a case manager in juvenile detention. Mm. I worked in observation and assessment, assessing risk to recidivate so treatment plans could be better developed and implemented. And then through that course, I ended up in the research and planning division at the juvenile justice department that I worked in. And I thought, I need to go back to school. I need to learn more about, you know, more practices. I have the epidemiology background. I have the public health background. I understand criminal justice and the connections, but I need to understand more about research and evaluation. So after getting married, having a child, then I went back to school and got my master's. So that's kind of where that weird pathway into the criminal justice. Or I won't say weird, I'll say unique.
Unique pathway. That's a good word.
Despite the career progression and working in an area that she was very passionate about, Dr. Loeffler-Kolbia wasn't done. Almost 30 years from when she completed her bachelor's, she finished her DRPH degree. She shares her reasons.
Yeah. And then even maybe double uniquely, we go from a 30-year span from pretty much when you completed your, and don't mean to date you, but
it's okay.
30-year span from 1996 when you completed your bachelor's to then doing a DRPH, completing that fairly recently. You're getting all these experiences. You're having this different impact. You're in the criminal justice work, intersecting with public health. And why that impetus to go and then do a DRPH after all of that?
Because I'm crazy.
You said it, not me.
I know. So here's the thing. You know, I've been doing this work for, as you said, many years, Gordon. You know, doing this work, but over the last maybe, I want to say, 10 years, what I was really starting to dive in is kind of this systems thinking. How do we pull systems together to really think at a systems lens rather than just thinking at a criminal justice lens and reducing recidivism, or thinking through the public health lens and maybe looking at prescription drug monitoring programs to address the opioid overdose epidemic, or just thinking through harm reduction, right? Those are very siloed pieces that are effective, but what happens when we come together and really think through it as a system lens to get better outcomes? And again, going back to kind of my first initial thought of being becoming a medical doctor, it was always a goal of mine to become a doctor in some capacity and just have that extra level of education. But working full time and doing my master's and then having a child who's also, he's very athletic. He's we were very engaged in his upbringing, right? It just wasn't the time. So the crazy part is once he went off to school into college, which, by the way, he's an athlete playing at the college level and has won two regional championship rings. Once he went off to school, I thought, oh, I'll go back to school. I'm bored. I have nothing else to do now. Right? So it was just a goal. And I said, I need to have this next level of education. And so I went into my DRPH program at the University of South Florida.
So why DRPH over a PhD is a question everyone always asks. In your specific case, what led you to that decision?
I'm a systems thinker. I'm a policy developer. I'm an implementation facilitator, if you will. And I just wanted to have more of that background in policy and implementation and practice rather than the more of a background in research and evaluation. I'm one that is very passionate about bringing the research that is done through research and evaluation and bringing that to life in policy and practice, and really being able to implement it to make change in systems. And so I felt the DRPH, the Doctor of Public Health, was going to be more effective to continue me down that path.
In her 20 plus years of experience working in the justice, public health, and community settings, Dr. Jennifer Loeffler-Kolbia has led discussions on Capitol Hill about problematic substance use prevention, criminal justice reform, and even work with other states to develop and implement opioid prevention and reduction strategic plans. She shares what it's like to advocate for buy-in with policymakers who hold a variety of different viewpoints. So speaking of systems thinking approach and all these bigger picture policy development and policy advocacy pieces, one of the interesting things that I read about you was that you've gone to Capitol Hill in front of the U.S. Congress on various expert panels to share your expertise on the subject of recidivism, criminal justice, opioids, substance use, the whole works. So when I watch these things on TV, I'm very terrified. You're all around these senators, congressmen, and it looks very terrifying. How did you prepare for those? And like, what's the most memorable experience you've had on Capitol Hill?
So I'm not sure if terrifying is the word that I would use. Stressful, yes. But I say stressful in the manner that when you're working with policymakers, especially at that level, I think the stressful part is you want to engage them. You want to get to a level for them of buy-in. Why is this important? Why is this topic that we're discussing important? And why is it that it's so important that we need to have policy change? Right. We need to have, at that level, policy change. Because if we can get the policy change, then that trickles down into our communities and the way that our communities interact and change, how our families and our direct relationships change, and how us as individuals change. So I guess that stressful piece is just really trying to engage them and make them understand how important whatever topic it is that you're talking about. I think the best thing when you're working at that level is to find a champion within either whether it's in the House of Representatives or within the Senate, to find one of those champions, and hopefully bipartisan. I'm always looking for efforts and ways to be bipartisan, especially when we're talking about substance misuse and substance use disorders. But finding that champion in Congress to help you build the process to be able to bring in experts, be able to bring in the press, be able to bring in other staffers of other congressmen and women, to be able to hear and listen to what you have to say. And have that legislator be a part of the process, right? And sometimes I think that's the difficult part, is getting that buy-in and then being able to put that together in partnership with someone at that level of policy.
Thanks so much for sharing that. And it was great going through your many years of experience and the amazing and rich
Thanks, LaShawn.
I'm in the doghouse.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Gordon.
As you all know, with each of our guests, we like to switch things up by taking a break from this deep and vulnerable discussion and launch right into our Insight Blitz segment, where we surprise our guests with seemingly random questions to get their immediate reactions and responses. For this one, LaShawn explores a few things, from what comes to mind when she thinks of Utah, to the worst piece of advice she's gotten, and of course, just because we really had to, her recommendation for a TV show that most accurately depicts the opioid crisis. Up next.
So with all that in mind, we want to take you to our next segment of the podcast. Are you ready for rapid fire questions?
Absolutely.
Okay, amazing. So in this segment called Insight Blitz, we're going to ask you questions or read some statements, and it's going to be your job to provide us with some brief responses. Are you ready to begin?
I'm going to try, do my best.
All right. First question, what is your favorite thing to do in your spare time?
My favorite thing to do in my spare time is be with my husband and our dogs. So that's currently where we are at in our life. And we love to hike. I live in Utah, so we have a lot of tall mountains, a lot of hikes, a lot of beautiful scenery. So we are outdoors as much as we can and hiking and doing outdoor activities with our dogs. We have a little Labradoodle named Mac, and we have a, I'm gonna call him a golden lab, because he's part lab, part golden retriever, and his name's Rip.
Oh, love that, love that. Yep. You know, that really resonates with me, because last year I had the chance to visit Utah, specifically Zion National Park, and it is my favorite place on earth, I gotta say.
Yes, we were just down there over the weekend, last weekend, to get away from the cold and the snow up north. And it's just breathtaking.
Lucky
Southern Utah is just
lucky
breathtaking.
You. Just a casual weekend, you know.
Yeah, just the, you know, little drive.
Gordon, I gotta take you to Utah.
Yes, you both are welcome anytime, honestly.
Anytime. Love that. What is your favorite food?
Oh gosh. Okay, so my favorite food is pizza.
Ooh.
And then anything Italian. Anything Italian. The problem is the carbs, you know, so. Trying to get my husband and I on a less carb diet, but really hard when your favorite food is pizza and Italian food.
Yeah. So, like you already mentioned, you're from Utah, and it's been a big part of your life. So, what comes to mind when you think about Utah?
Beauty and the people. Yep. It is just a beautiful state geographically, from northern Utah, which is very forest, mountains, to southern Utah, which is very red rock, hills, and you know, mountainous scenery. And then the people. The people in Utah are just extremely friendly and nice and welcoming.
What is the worst piece of advice you've ever gotten?
Oh gosh. Worst piece of advice I've ever gotten is probably not to I'm going to say this globally, but not to explore education. I think we have a culture right now too of what is the importance of education, and I think that's a really dangerous path. So I've been told, you're already doing this work, you've been in the field for so many years, why are you getting another degree or moving towards a doctorate degree? And I just feel like education is key. Whether it's a degree or you're just learning on a daily basis, we have to continue learning all the time. And I think that could be that was some dangerous advice, is to say, why would you pursue another degree when you're already in this field?
True or false? You taught a course called Social Marketing and Health in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let's see. Oh, that's the question.
Yeah.
I taught a social marketing in 20... Yes, true, at Utah State University. Yes, I had to think about that.
What was that about?
So the social marketing class that I taught was really thinking through how can we better disseminate information about public health through our current social marketing media platforms, whether it's Facebook, or I know I'm dating myself again on Facebook, but Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, all of these different avenues, and the messages that we disseminate through public health, and how do we disseminate the right types of messages for the right type of our target population, and how do we utilize pieces of research to help us better understand how we can improve our marketing and messages in public health.
Wonderful. So the next question would be, what movie or TV show most accurately depicts the unfolding of the opioid crisis?
Dope Sick.
Okay, so that was a quick answer.
I've seen it,
and I tend to agree.
Just the chronological events that we experienced with the opioid epidemic and Big Pharma, and how it got, so involved in the epidemic and how it took such a big toll on our society and the way that we view prescription drugs and really how we got here.
Okay, wonderful. Another true or false question. True or false, there is a fentanyl vaccine?
Well, there's not a vaccine, no. In the true sense of a vaccine, like you would say, like the COVID vaccine or the measles vaccine. But there are medications, medical assisted treatment, that can help with the withdrawals, mm-hmm. buprenorphine, methadone, naltrexone, to help folks get, address their substance use disorder, but no vaccine at this time. People have been talking about the vaccines of treating substance use disorders, but that would be prevention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we don't have that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We don't have, a vaccine is mm-hmm. to prevent, mm-hmm. right? But we do have medications that help with the substance use disorder.
Mm.
To prevent further overdoses. Right. So I just want to make sure that's clear.
Okay, wonderful. So that brings us to the end of the Insight Blitz segment. How was that? Not too bad, right?
That was great.
Coming up next, the second episode in this three-part miniseries with Dr. Jennifer Loeffler-Cobia, where we do something we've never done before on the podcast. That is going through a chronological timeline of the opioid epidemic. From its early use in history to the role of Big Pharma, and to the present-day realities involving the introduction of potent synthetic opioids and other components. That's next time on the story of the opioid epidemic on the Public Health Insight podcast. This show was edited by me, Gordon Thain, with additional editing from LaShawn Benedict. Sound design and mixing by myself and LaShawn Benedict. The original music from The Music Room, composed by Tom Fox, licensed from Johnny Harris. The cover art design for our show by LaShawn Benedict. The Public Health Insight podcast is produced by PHI Media. Thank you for listening to the Public Health Insight podcast, your go-to space for informative conversations, inspiring community action. If you enjoy our podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. See you in the next one.